Blog Talk Radio.
Wisdom and harmony filling earth, brotherly love. Good evening, everyone. You're now tuned into Soul Class number 130, In Search of Ancient Authentic Torah, series number 30. This is your cyberspace Torah activist, Dunzusia Goodman, and we're going to go now into our intro. We want to let everyone know, as usual, that Soul is an acronym for S70, oldest, original, universal El laws, the seven Noahide commandments, and tersely spoken out, these are, number one, not to blaspheme the Creator with the name of the Creator, number two, not to commit acts of idolatry, three, not to commit premeditated acts of murder, four, not to commit acts of adultery, five, not to steal, six, to not to eat the limb of an animal while it's still alive, and seven, to raise up righteous statutes among all the inhabitants of the Kol Bo Olam. And this includes the following teaching. And before we go into it, I'd like to call on and acknowledge our co-host, Ms. Ryan, our teacher, our student, our advocate for the dissemination of the teaching of Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon Maimonides. Good evening, Dennis.
Good evening, Don.
Good evening. And we also have, if I'm not mistaken, I believe this is the call number of Karchel Gore, our Booker T. Washington president. Good evening, Ben Dod.
Erev Tov, Ben Dod. Mashalom Ha.
Kolbe said everything's good. So, gentlemen, we want to go right into the show now. We mentioned that the Seventh Commandment, which really related to implementing righteous statutes in all the laws of the creation for every country. Here's an idea that I want to throw out to both of you gentlemen. This started back in 1986, and I talked about it once on the program, and I found the article, which was written by Professor Yirmiyahu Branover, chairman of the Center of Magnohydrodynamic Studies and Training at Ben-Gurion University in Israel. And he writes the following. In 1986, the first international conference on health promotion was held, during which the famous, quote, Ottawa Declaration, unquote, was signed. The declaration enunciated the principles and turned international convention on its head and established a new standard for human health. No longer would health be defined as the absence of illness. The new conception of health is a state whereas a person has all the necessary conditions to reach his or her full physical, mental, and spiritual potential. The Ottawa Declaration states that every person, wherever he or she may be, is entitled to a supportive environment to help him or her achieve greatness. It is the duty of the states, referring to, I guess, all the countries of the world as well, to provide their citizens with peace, adequate food, a stable ecology, access to educational and medical resources, social justice and equality. All political and societal forces, governmental, economic, industrial, social, cultural, and environmental, must mobilize in order to enable all people to achieve and realize their health potential. Health promotion is a new field more advanced and far-reaching than preventative medicine. Its aim is not merely to prevent an illness, but to ensure the highest level of wellness and functioning by all members of society. In order to ensure this, we need to look at health not only on an individual level, but a communal and societal level. Only when all these factors are functioning in an optimum way can each individual reach their maximum potential. So Professor Branover wants this question, a new field, did we say? Well, not quite. This concept is actually quite an ancient one, which we find articulated by none other than Maimonides as a ruling in the Jewish teachings of the Torah, quote, being that a healthy and whole body is part of divine service, unquote. With this statement, Maimonides established that good health is a prerequisite to serving Almighty and also, of course, to be in fellowship with other people. So we need all the proper physical conditions to be in place so that we can, in turn, devote ourselves to serving God fully. And this goal will be fully fulfilled in its entirety with the true and complete redemption, described by Maimonides as the era of the ultimate perfection, quote, and in that time there will be no hunger, no war, no jealousy, no competition. All good things will be freely available and all delicacies will be as accessible as dust, unquote. So what would be the purpose of all this bounty? Maimonides continues in the last law in his teaching of Mishneh Torah, and the sole occupation of the world will be to know God, unquote. So this state of perfect health and abundance will enable us to fulfill the purpose of creation, to experience godliness within the physical world. We're not talking about an ethereal utopian world. We're talking about a physical world where we can experience spirituality as we understand to be godliness. According to our prophets, all ailments will be healed and death will be eradicated forever. So I bit off a lot, and I'm still chewing on it, gentlemen. But Dennis, what is your take on this idea, and any suggestions to the human family, what we all can do on an individual basis to talk about this matter with other people?
Well, first of all, Don, it sounds like you just took on the world. What happens is we all live in countries that have different organizations or orientation. You mentioned Canada there, right?
Right.
Basically a socialistic type of country. In America here, we practice capitalism. Now, what happens is we believe that you're entitled to good health if you have a problem and if you can handle it yourself. To think that any government would guarantee you good health, that's stretching a point on. That's almost like saying health is the most important issue in the world. If it was, then most of what you said would probably fit in. But we have other rankings of other things that become more important. And when that happens, we tend to push health down a bit. And unfortunately, from a selfish viewpoint, we have people that say every person for themselves. However, we do have an obligation to take care of those people who need it, want it, and deserve it. So other than that, I can't go too much further because politics interferes with this subject when it probably shouldn't, but it does.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll respond to that. But, Cartrell, what are your thoughts on this matter?
I don't really have a comment at the moment.
Okay. Well, the thing is Dennis, I just want to mention that, you know, going back in time, I mean, I myself lived in a farming community, in particular in a place called Adam, Lowville, New York, and I lived on a farm where the farmer, although you worked for him, it was a capitalist venture. People were provided with makeshift homes, something that afforded them some level of dignity. I mean, they didn't live in castles, and most of these workers did have access to, say, Medicaid benefits, whatever. The thing is this, the essential point of the human condition is, which side of the coin are we on? And all of us, I hopefully, are on the side of Abel and not Cain, because the question of whether or not I'm my brother's keeper really, I think, is something which supersedes any consideration of any political system. And we see as the world gets smaller and smaller via the aegis of communications, it's not a question of, so to speak, myself, Don Goodman, taking on the world. It's a matter of calling to the attention of the ears, hearts, minds, and souls of the blessed children of Noah and also the Jewish people. Are we going to take the stand in these final days before the universal redemption to promote values which would hopefully be in consonance with being our brother's keeper? Or are we going to say, it's not my problem? Now, most of us logistically, financially, are unable to save the world, literally not even able to save our own city. But the whole idea of getting these concepts out into the faculty of human speech, and here now it's being shared in the realm of the Internet, will hopefully arouse people. So, see, because these are issues beyond political systems. Because, you know, God is older than there's no age to the Almighty. And we do know that there were times of prosperity in ancient civilizations, and there were times of famine in ancient civilizations, whether it be Israelite or otherwise. And many times the bounty which happened during civilizations which were full of idolatry quickly crashed to the ground, and civilizations that were struggling that repented, say like the city of Nineveh, they had bounty because people were stealing, but they repented and they were spared destruction. The five municipalities of Sodom and Gomorrah, as we call it, the prophet Yehezkel said they were destroyed because of the fact that they did not take heed of the cry of the poor, of the orphan, the widow. So, you know, we don't have one particular answer that will be suitable for the American political capitalist system or the Canadian system or Russia. I don't claim that. But the fact that we can speak it out, and someone over in Canada or someone out in South Africa or someone in Saudi Arabia will hear these words, and I know that there's someone who I connect with from Jordan, someone will hear these words and perhaps people will get inspired to work out a plan. I mean, I am not of the faithful of a doomsday scenario before the Mashiach comes. I am of the scenario that if people repent, turn back to the Most High, we can gradually access a level of bounty into the creation, which is not supernatural, but rather we see the elevation of the nature of people. So basically, I'm trying to invest my effort, my faith in the goodness of humanity, despite the fact we have, unfortunately, there's some bad apples walking around, and all of us have a little bad apple inside of ourselves we have to rectify. So that I don't know if that clarifies everything I'm trying to say, but I'm just trying to throw something out to lubricate what I like to call the human intelligence, to connect to the divine image, to look into the possibilities of a particular scenario, and what could we do on an individual basis. I want to just give one more example, and then I'll be welcome to questions and comments by either one of you two gentlemen. I was listening this morning to a radio program on The Fan, which is a sports radio talk show, but this morning they have a community service program where there was a gerontologist, because there is an issue here in the West, that the baby boomers are getting older and older. So this doctor, who's a gerontologist, was asked a simple question. Doctor, how did you get into this field? Well, it happens to be that she's of an Italian heritage, and you know, like all other families of the earth, the Italian culture is very family-oriented. And she remarked how the thing that changed her life is that her grandmother, who passed away at the age of 97, spent the last 18 years of her life in the home of her mother. And her mother was a professional nurse and gave her such care with such a personal touch, it inspired her that if she was going into the medical field, she would choose gerontology, even though she said it's not the most lucrative of the fields. Now she herself is running an institute and is a consultant to ensure that people who are reaching their senior years should be given the best possible care towards the end of their life. So the ripple effect is that you say you have nurses, nurses' aides, and attendants who are in their teens or their 20s and 30s and 40s, and they get, and as well as making a salary, although maybe not a great salary, they're getting educated to treat the elders with respect. So hopefully when they start their own families, it's such a ripple effect of giving more respect to the elders. So I spoke a lot. I apologize, gentlemen, but I just want to – these are burning issues in my heart. Dennis, any response?
Yes. If you love God, you must love your neighbor. If you love your neighbor, you must be his keeper. If you are his keeper, you must be able to do it on a sensible basis. And uh-huh. You mentioned some previous societies where I guess you were trying to show that there are ups and downs. Now, any affluent society, if it can afford to, will take more care of people, and there's nothing wrong with that. However, when it's not so affluent and people decide that we got to go further on down the list as to what we can handle or address from a government, community, et cetera level, we sometimes take shortcuts and we leave out people. Why? Because the poorest of people who are usually injured in some way, shape, or form, who have more problems than, let's say, rich people, don't usually have a spokesman that can stand up for them, while the people who have the wealth can certainly push their weight around. So we have an imbalance as it comes to on a human scale here, and we just can't wipe it out. It would be nice if we could, but it's always going to be there. Are humans biased and are they looking the other way? Sometimes a lot of humans are lazy and prefer to look the other way.
True. Carcho, any commentary on our discussion so far?
I'm afraid I've been listening, Barry. I don't have anything to comment on at the moment. I was just running my mind. Well, I was once discussing Cain and Abel with a Hindu associate.
Uh-huh.
And as I recall, one was a meat eater, one was a vegetarian.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as the creator preferred the meat eater to the vegetarian, if I am not mistaken. That's something I just remember. Some years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So with that being said, I want to go into something. Several weeks back, Dennis brought up a point that his points of admiration for Rambam is that his way was not in rebuking with implications of fire and brimstone. And I'd like to give a modern example of that. This happened 21 years ago. in relation to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. I happened to be living in Israel at the time, and it was right before the first Gulf War broke out. And if those of you don't remember, I can tell you, because I heard every air raid siren that blew every time Saddam Hussein and the forces who worked with him shot 39 Scud missiles into the land of Israel. But before that, about 3 weeks before, there happened to be actually a rabbi in B'nai Brak who was publicizing, in the Rebbe's view, a very disturbing view that God was out to punish his people, God forbid, due to their many sins, that we were standing at the brink of a second Holocaust. May we be spared of such things. So it happened to be on a fast day, which we observed a couple of weeks ago, the 10th of Tevis, which recalls the day that Nebuchadnezzar, the ancient king of Babylon, breached the outer wall of Jerusalem, and several months later he would actually participate in the destruction of the first temple. So that day, the rhetoric of that rabbi out of B'nai Brak, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, wanted to refute that statement that such a horrible consequence could happen at that time, 21 years ago. And he admonished, he rebuked those who openly disdained the Jewish people of our generation. And the Rebbe had renounced the claim that another Holocaust was upon us, and heaven forbid that it should come directly out of the Jewish people's sins. And that he was very angered by the idea that the person was suggesting that the ones who had been slaughtered in the Holocaust was because of the sin. Now, this is a matter of great, great depth, which I'm not really going to go into as much as him and his father-in-law, the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, when they would speak to the great rabbis of the previous generation and this generation, would get very upset when they would try to justify the Holocaust based on the lack of the performance of the commandments. And they were saying, basically, there are certain secrets unto God that none of us can penetrate into. And then that the Shabbos that followed, the Sabbath that followed that first initial statement by the Rebbe rebuking that rabbi, that he spoke sternly and with a fiery passion concerning that those who dare to open their mouths and prosecute against, you know, the Most High's children, that it was basically out of his love for the nation of Israel. Now, what he said basically is the following. In that time, with all the news that we've heard lately around the world, we found something really new, that a mere man of flesh and blood mixes into the plans of the Creator and decides what he's going to do with his people, acts of negativity. He then goes ahead and teaches this school of thought to his students and leads them astray off the beaten path. In fact, he led himself off the beaten path. And by doing so, the Rebbe used a very strong expression that the Holocaust this person is trying to predict is actually, he's bringing a type of Holocaust, a spiritual Holocaust upon himself. So let this person and all people learn from Isaiah the prophet, and the name Yeshaya or Yeshayahu actually is coming from the word of Savior, for he was involved in helping the Jews of that time, and he put his own life on the line when he said, quote, "May God, Hashem, rebuke you, Satan," unquote, thereby teaching a lesson for future generations never to speak against the nation of Israel and give fuel to the Satan, heaven forbid. So we've seen that in this generation, many people came back. Now, I want to also universalize this and expand on my own responsibility, that this also is inclusive of the children of Noah, because many people are predicting various doomsday scenarios in order for the Messiah, the Mashiach, to come. And they should know that basically they're judging themselves, because we do know this, that from the teaching of the ethics of our fathers of Israel, that everything the Most High created was for his own glory, that includes all the peoples of the earth, and how much more so that is included in that teaching is the understanding that Rabbi Akiva, that beloved is man, that he was instructed and taught that he was created in the image of the Almighty. So with that being said, we have to be very careful this time of souls, because, you know, there's a lot of negativity and a lot of worries and concern about war and pestilence and all sorts of scenarios. But the human mind, and a student of Rambam, would definitely advocate, in the meantime that you're using your energy to worry about the worst-case scenarios, what are you doing in your individual life to try to create a microcosmic positive scenario in your life and the life of others? Dennis, would you like to comment on that big
yeah.
big chunk of opinion that I just shared with other people?
Well, that involves some moral principles and a level of faith and belief, because we have little children who are 3-4 months old, let's say, they just die. We don't know what they die of, but we don't sit around worrying about it because we believe they're in God's hands. And if you're a believer, you will say, God knows. So when things happen, we don't worry about the past because we live for now and the future. And now and the future depends on how strong your faith is. Humans cannot come up with the answers that God has reserved for himself.
That's
you
right.
cannot do that. If you want to waste your time as to what has happened in history, other than to say that it's a lesson that we should watch out for so we don't repeat it. But unfortunately, the history of humans says we repeat and repeat and repeat. So I usually tell people, don't worry about what's happened in the past. If your faith and belief is strong enough, there's hope for the future.
That's right. That's right. We somehow got to this point in time. So hopefully we're going to get to the next point in time. And at this point in time, Dennis, can you please share with us, and I'm proud to say that based on Dennis' great advice, I picked up the book myself, and I want to openly recommend everyone check this book out. It's published by Aronson Publishers, A-R-O-N-S-O-N. And Moses Maimonides, physician, scientist, and philosopher. So, Dennis, what page do you want to take us to that I can follow along, hopefully make the conversation more organic based on what you want to read?
I'm going to pick up where I left off the last time, Don, and that is on page 51.
Okay, page 51. Let me get there right with you. And my coordinates are right with you. I'm ready.
I'm reading. The definition of mental illness is based on Maimonides' interpretation of the Babylonian Talmud in Haggadah 3b, in which the symptoms of insanity are presented as follows. Who is an insane person? Shote. Now, shote is an interesting word. And I did some research on it. This is not in the book right now. Rashi puts the concept of shote in context by explaining that a shote is exempt from halachic obligations, exonerated from punishment, and prevented from participating in business transactions.
Mm-hmm.
That was my research. Now I'm going back to the book.
Mm-hmm.
One who goes out alone at night, one who spends the night in a cemetery, and who rends his garments. Rends means tear.
Right.
Talmud then presents two differing opinions as to the definition of insanity. Rabbi Huna states that a person must manifest all three symptoms delineated to be considered a shote, and in parentheses we have legally insane, since any one of the actions may have a logical explanation and does not therefore constitute insanity. Rabbi Yohanan claims that even if a person performs only one of the actions listed in the Talmud, he may be considered insane as long as it occurs in a deranged manner.
Mm-hmm.
The Jerusalem Talmud, Terminat 1:1, adds that the shote is one who destroys all that is given to him. Maimonides interprets the symptoms noted in the Talmud to be merely examples of mental illness. He broadens the legal definition of insanity from very limited narrow criteria, so that it includes any symptoms that indicate confusion or psychosis, whether the etiology is mental illness, mental retardation, or a physical illness. Maimonides gives discretionary power to the judge to make individual decisions in each particular case, implying also that the possibility of the judge may request expert testimony of a medical nature to help determine the particular state of the person being judged, competent or incompetent. This is a very modern concept, and Maimonides interprets the Talmudic source in this manner, in marked contrast to a very narrow definitions of other halachic legal authorities of his time,
such as Rabino Shimha of Speyer and Rabino Avador HaKohen, who limit the definitions of mental illness to the examples given in the Talmud. Maimonides choose to place this definition of insanity in the laws of witness, where it is incorporated into the effort of defining competence and understanding of events, actions, ideas. The perspective was influenced not only by Maimonides' interpretation of the Talmudic source, but also by his experience as a physician. He recognized that there are many biological conditions as well as psychological states that can influence the functioning of the mind. Each case should be adjudicated individually within the broad guidelines that allow for different diagnoses as well as specific mental status examination. The complexities of mental illnesses were understood by Maimonides, the physician, from his own clinical experience, and he reached the halachic conclusion that to attempt to define mental illness legally by specifying only the particular systems listed in the Talmud was too limiting. This had serious legal ramifications, such as in the laws of divorce, since granting a divorce requires full understanding and competence in more difficult to accomplish if symptoms other than those enumerated in the Talmud are evident. Rabbi Shimon of Speyer and Rabino Avador HaKohen limit the definition of mental illness for this reason. For Maimonides, however, the Talmudic definition did not fit his clinical experience, and he could not limit the definition to legal competence despite the motivation to do so.
Beautiful. So I have so much to comment in this, Dennis, because, you know, I am in the field of mental health. And what Maimonides did was, I think he opened up the door that we see today in terms of, for instance, the implementation of people having, for instance, getting SSI or SSD benefits from Social Security, from the federal government, is that, in fact, although there's no judge, basically, I as an advocate working with people with mental illness, that basically there is a series of criteria that must be met by the person who is diagnosed by none other than a psychiatrist, who in a sense is a type of medical judge, and basically the criteria given to what defines mental illness is defined by the, you know, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. I think it's up to a volume. It's in stage 4 or volume 4. They've had three previous editions, and therefore the person is able to get a certain amount of money. They get food stamps. They get Medicaid. Each one has their particular case, and that's basically what goes on. Each individual, you cannot link together all people with schizophrenia as being just having the same type of mental illness. And in fact, one of the things that we try to do in our program, which I'm not allowed to say the name of where I work for because of legal reasons, that we were told by one of the clients, said that I am not my diagnosis. Yet, still, they are in a certain way disempowered by what is called mental illness. And therefore, how Maimonides could not find himself constricted by the Talmudic teaching is totally in sync to the idea that although what people don't understand, Talmudic thinking at the time was a way, and still is, it's a type of reasoning that takes place in how to fill in the gaps between the literal scriptural teachings. And it was never meant to be to be just left as cut and dry oral law tradition, but rather it should be as it applied to the practical living reality. So in the times of the Talmud and the times preceding the Talmud, the Jewish people basically lived in agrarian societies, and there were certain cities, but nothing like the sprawling metropolitan cities that we have today of New York City, Brooklyn, Sacramento, Moscow, Beijing, that people, you know, it was more soothing for a person with mental illness, and this has been shown clinically already, that in a rural environment, a person with this type of disability could be more adaptive and hopefully more useful living in a rural society. But as people started moving and gathering together in cities, it became more apparent and more out of the context of what we call, quote-unquote, normal behavior. So therefore, there had to be some sort of reckoning of how to deal with this certain segment of the human population. Unfortunately, in American modern societies in New York City, in the five boroughs, when we had the tragedy and the travesty of Willowbrook, which you probably remember, Dennis, and for those who are not aware, Willowbrook was a state mental health facility in Staten Island, New York, where people were literally being chained to beds and left in urine and feces-soaked diapers for several days. This is also not the solution. So Rambam's approach, which I think was a pedestal and a giving over of strength to the modern mental health movement, which, again, a very well-known psychiatrist that I know in New York City told me once that, you know, and he agreed with my statement that the state of mental health care, and even for people who are, quote-unquote, mentally retarded or mentally delayed, is still at the level of what a car was in 1920, meaning the human conditions require that we ourselves, as facilitators of health care, all different types of health care, are going to have to try to make improvements. Now, also, we're dealing with the economic realities of today, and on the state and federal level, many cuts, almost to the jugular vein, have been made in social services. So it's a tough call, and that's why we are, as a Jewish individual, I'm urging people to pray, not only for bounty, but as the bounty starts to refill the coffers of businesses, that businesses in a symbiotic relationship with governmental forces can ensure that that mental health care and wellness care can go to the next level and not further regress. Dennis, any comments about what I just said?
I basically agree with you, Don, but at the same time, you must remember reality has a place here. And that is, if everybody who is judged to have some type of a mental problem, you would decrease the population that's walking around on the streets, okay? So what we have is a thing called functionality. If a person can function, we say, let them take a little medicine and walk along the street with all the normal people. And we tend to do that. But then again, most of us have said, gee, that person must be crazy. I mean, if you accidentally bump into them and they start yelling and screaming at you and blah, 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 you think that's out of the normal. So there's a lot of people, and we've seen a lot of people who try to use that as an excuse for committing crimes or other things against other people, like somebody who forgot to take their medicine. The doctor told me to take this medicine, but I didn't take it. So they went out and committed a crime of some type. Is that really an excuse? Or are we putting too many functional people out on the street hoping that they'll take their medicine? However, be that as it may, I just wanted to come out with another thing here. In the Mishnah Torah, we have Maimonides given a more specific definition of shote. And in the Hilchot Idut 7, he states that a shote is someone who is unable to disseminate between contradictory ideas, is impulsive, or is disoriented. Now, that is a more general idea than what I've stated so far from the book. So it's very hard to put this into words because each individual case requires some type of analysis to separate it from another one. That's why we don't group all these people together. In other words, if you ask the psychologist, a psychiatrist even, how bad is this person from a mental viewpoint, well, he has a list of maybe about 24, two dozen different categories that he could fit somebody into. So it's a tough human problem. We are our brother's keeper, and we must handle some of these people.
Sure. I just want to mention this, that by the way, I heard this from a psychiatrist a couple of years ago, and the number probably went up, that one out of every eight people walking around in America now are in fact walking around with diagnosed and undiagnosed forms of some sort of disabling mental condition, meaning depression, bipolar, schizophrenia, and what percentage of them are taking medicine? Well, we know at least 12% of, well, one out of eight would be, about 12% of people walking around in the country are walking around where they could potentially be a hazard. And as far, I know in New York City it applies. Unfortunately, several years ago, there was a young man from upstate New York who pushed, unfortunately, a young woman from upstate New York off a railroad platform in the New York City subway system, and she died. I mean, she had everything to live for, and he was off his medication. So there's a law now called the Kendra Law, where people who are diagnosed at a certain level, that if they don't take their medication, they will become dysfunctional and, in fact, injurious to themselves and to society. They will wind up being in state psych. They will be hospitalized, or many of them, in fact, are legally forced to take injections of different types of medications. Now, again, is it the solution? Ultimately, no. But it, in the meantime, until the human endeavor to try to soften the blow that people have who incur, whether they, Rambam mentioned in that teaching, Dennis, the idea of something happening to the brain of the person. I mean, I don't know if Rambam wrote about traumatic brain injury. I mean, I just heard of a case recently where a person, had a PhD in psychology and was assessing people, and something happened. And it could have been from the scenario that was given to me that he had a TBI, a traumatic brain, incident. And, so all these factors involved require for us, again, and just my heartfelt prayer, and by the way, I want to welcome back on the line Cardinal Gore. I see he's back on the line. How much we should be satisfied. One of the things I learned from my Rebbe is never be satisfied, meaning we cannot go, if we're going to be honest with ourselves as human beings, we can't go around polishing our buttons and saying we live in the greatest city in the world or the greatest civilization of the world or this or that thing, meaning what can we do to, because when we get to be the greatest civilization of the world, we won't have to call ourselves the greatest because it'll be so obvious. People will want to emulate the greatness that our quote-unquote civilization has to offer because we are living examples of what greatness is. Not have to PR our way into getting to self-deluded notions of what greatness is, when actually, there are many aspects of modern civilization which are, I'm going to put my cards on the table, quite mediocre by the standards of basic human decency. Cartrell, any comments on these matters?
Yes, I do have a comment now, and that is, like, as a teacher, I see these situations. I had a student, and when I asked him why wasn't he coming to high school, he told me he wasn't coming to high school because the voices keep telling him to stab and kill people.
Ooh.
Yes, so to make a long story short, what I did, I don't want to, just to make a long story short, aside from what I did within the school system, I took the extra step to go outside the school system and call his local police precinct. And they told me that they would send him a free psychiatrist. But they could not, if I gave them his name and address, they would send him a free psychiatrist, but they could not report on me the results. To my knowledge, he never went off the deep end.
He never went off?
No, to my knowledge, he never went off the deep end, to my knowledge.
Did he get treatment?
He did get treatment for 5 days, and I think he needed more treatment than that. That was within the school system. Within the school system, I knew him to get treatment for 5 days, which I did not feel was sufficient, in my opinion.
Yeah, from my opinion, someone who is making a threat of doing that, and especially if they have a specific plan to say they have a gun or a knife, that's a person who needs a serious psychiatric evaluation, or it could be in the case of an adolescent that it's a cry for help that perhaps his or her needs are not being met sufficiently in the home, and it's a cry for attention. I mean, I don't know this person individually, but I'm just saying from my experience in this field of mental health that extreme statements which are proclamations of being of engaging in self-injurious or injurious behavior to other members of society, certainly warrants a serious review by a health professional or a mental health professional to make sure that the person is not going to act on it, and maybe there's a core issue. Many, you know, unfortunately, you know, and one of the things I noticed too with people who are suffering in their mental infirmities is that sometimes they make a lot of big statements, and then when you just listen to them and listen to them and listen to them, then they say, well, really what's bothering them is that their wife is not cleaning the house. Or maybe it's because they don't have a job. So, you know, part of our jobs as human beings is sometimes we should be greater listeners than talkers. And sometimes when you hear a person talking with such, expressing verbal violence, it's really that because they were never educated. Not that they don't have the mental capacity. They were never educated or encouraged to share what's really bothering them. Dennis, any comments on that?
Yes, I live in New York, as you do, Don. And it is considered one of the greatest cities. But we also have some of the greatest collections of people here. And we bump into them all the time, be it taking a railroad, a bus, a subway, just walking along the street, you're going to bump into them. After a while, we learn how to recognize some of these telltale signs of how they use their hands, how they stand up, are they twitching their head, are their eyes jumping all over the place, and are they snorting? I mean, you just look for someone who's not a completely normal, if you can find that category. But we manage to stay away from those people, not to antagonize them or cause them a problem. And we will say a little prayer and hope that everything will turn out better for them.
Amen. So, gentlemen, what I want to do now is take about a three-minute break. I've been playing a series of songs by a Reb Lazer Brody, who is a Breslev Chassid out in Israel. This song is called 500 Miles. It's 6 minutes and 16 seconds, but I'm only going to play about 3 minutes of it. So, gentlemen, let's all sit back and relax, and anyone who's listening in, hopefully you're enjoying so far the first half of Soul Class in Search of Ancient Authentic Torah. This is 500 Miles from Reb Lazer Brody. Hold on, everyone. Let me just cue it up and enjoy. Okay, blessed souls, that was 500 Miles from the Laser Brody from his album Calming Waters, which was released last year. Rav Red Brody lives out in Ashdod, Israel, which is a coastal town right off the Mediterranean coast. And we're back live with co-host Dennis Ryan. Dennis, glad to have you back.
Okay.
And, okay, now we're going to move on, Dennis. We've been talking about attributes on how to acquire the Torah. And last week, of course, we didn't have a show, and I just want to send out a big shout-out of Mazel Tov again. Good fortune to the Metal family. Rabbi Yeshaya Metal married off his youngest son, Avram, to Ariella. And I wish all the blessed world to the Mishpacha Metal, the Metal family, Ariella and Avrami. Avram and Ariella Metal, and they should have a wonderful life together with all the nachas, all the good things in life, and of course for any young couple out there that have the faith. I mean, it takes faith now, blessed souls, because it's not the greatest of economies to start a new life under these conditions and to trust. It really, to get married is an expression of faith in the Almighty. But as we move on further, also I just want to mention the show is also dedicated to the elevation of a beautiful young neshama soul, a young woman who passed away, unfortunately, a month ago. Her name is Shema Bracha, Bas Rav Chaim Borovitz. She passed away a month ago, unfortunately, succumbing to the fatal disease that we know as cancer. And she was greatly respected, not only within our community in Crown Heights, but also in the Borough Park community and out in Long Island, wherever she went, because she became an advocate and advocate for thinking positively and promoting faith in God up until her last breath on this earth, that despite her sufferings, and she went through open heart surgery, she had brain surgery, she had chemotherapy, she lost all her hair. At the tender age of 18 and a half, not 19, she was taken. But before that, she gave a message to everyone. Despite the suffering, she was still positive and believed in the Creator that He was running the show. And although we are greatly pained by her loss, hopefully a book will hopefully be coming out in the future. And when it does, I will do my best to try to promote that book on this show that people can learn of this great faith of this young woman who left amidst Shena Bracha Borovitz, a blessed memory. So going on, talking about attributes on how to internalize the teachings of the Torah. 2 weeks ago, when we did the last show, we discussed with the all of you blessed souls, this idea of Einam Machazik Tova La'atzmo, and I defined it as a person who doesn't consider himself to be that great. I reviewed the teaching and I found a definition for that four-word phrase in Hebrew in English, and I think the English does justice much greater than the way I defined it. This whole idea that a person doesn't hold himself to be that great is basically what Rabbi Nachman was trying to say, according to the teachings of the sages. We should avoid being arrogant. So being arrogant is an impediment to absorbing the teachings of Scripture, whether it be written or oral tradition. So we're going to move on to the next attribute. And this is a very, very interesting contrast to the previous attribute. And this attribute, one of the 48 ways to acquire the Torah and internalize the Torah, is the attribute of being ahuv, meaning beloved. So Rabbi Nachman says the following, that you should know my beloved one and my son, which also includes women, that it's not possible to make an acquisition of the Torah unless a person loves himself. And we see that there are people who cast themselves down in their own eyes. We have Cartrell back. Welcome back, Cartrell.
Thank you.
We're talking about an attribute, Cartrell, about how to acquire the Torah, that a person should feel that they are beloved. And that some people, unfortunately, cast themselves down in their own opinions of themselves. And just like the Rebbe Nachman says, just as a person is required to believe in the Holy One, blessed be He, a person at a certain level should be able to believe in their self, to look at their good points. And he even mentions, Rabbi Nachman, that there have been righteous people who lived in the past, that although they were righteous, because they did not assert themselves in their righteousness at the right time and the right place in front of the right people, they actually brought on the judgment upon themselves from above, because there comes a point when sometimes you have to stand up for what is right. And the only way a person can stand up for what is right, blessed souls, is that when a person believes that they themselves are worthy of being beloved before the Most High. And that's one of the functions of this show, blessed souls, is everyone is beloved, because it says in Genesis 1:26 and 1:27, we were made in His image. Now, the Almighty Creator, you know, He created us in His image, so how could something in His image be something other than beloved? And that first, and what happens is when a person doesn't feel beloved enough, that they start to get lazy in their learning, and they start to get lazy in their prayer, their offerings of their mind, and their, and for those who want to, you can pray with your speech, faculty of speech. So it's very important that we have a balance. On the one hand, we shouldn't be arrogant. On the other hand, we have to be realize that we are beloved, and we have to have a certain love for ourselves. So it's like it's a delicate balance, which I would say, again, if I put my cards on the table, that you get to learn that balance only with age. It's very hard to find a 5-year-old or a 15-year-old or a 25-year-old, in rare occasions a 30-year-old, who's made that balance. But once you get into your 40s, you get into your 50s and older, you start to get that balance. Dennis, any comments on this? On how do we make that balance between avoiding being arrogant and avoiding too much self-love to the detriment of our balance as human beings?
Well, you must love yourself, because you can't love your fellow man unless you love yourself. You must love yourself because you must love God. But you can't love God unless you love yourself. If you don't understand love, you don't know how to use it. You're not part of the mainstream of the human race. So love is essential. Essential because if you don't use it or practice it, things start deteriorating over a period of time. And the balance is a very simple balance. If you want to be arrogant, you can be, but just a touch. After the touch, you put it away in your pocket, because that should satisfy your ego that you can be arrogant if you want to be. But just a touch, no more than that, because everybody will understand what you're doing.
Coach, again, you're a seasoned veteran of the human life experience. How do you suggest people try to find that balance, avoiding being too arrogant, and on the other hand, too, not loving oneself to the point of becoming selfish, self-centered in a damaging way, but to have a balance of, you know, knowing when to assert oneself and knowing how one should love oneself to be a contributing member of society?
Well, one thing starts with, I think, suggest that you should think before you speak and think before you act. There is something else called operational risk management, and think what you can gain and what you can lose before doing something. Something people ought to look into.
Mm-hmm. Now, you being in the you are now a retired member of the National Reserves?
Navy Reserves.
Navy Reserves. So, how in the Army, do they teach people how to maintain a balance, or is it just rote execution of the orders given by one superior? I mean, what do they do with soldiers who perhaps have an imbalanced psyche and are not mentally ill or mentally delayed? Did you observe how they would deal with individuals like that? How would they help them achieve some sort of balance?
First of all, I was in the Navy, but anyway, what they would do is something called operational risk management, and they talk. First of all, you do not obey illegal orders. That's a big no-no. You do not obey illegal orders. That's something you ought to. That's something that they have to make clear, that you don't do something. Just because you're told to do something, you should know right from wrong. And one of the things we teach is called operational risk management, both for, like, preventing accidents and just both in your military and in your civilian life. How do you analyze a situation to find out, is the risk worth the reward? You know, mm-hmm. That's something we have that's something that we cover in the service, in the Navy. Yeah.
Let me ask you this. So in the service, when a soldier comes in, becomes a member of the Armed Forces of America, are they given some sort of pamphlet or booklet? I mean, there could be potentially some gray areas of what would be illegal. I'm not talking about, you know, obviously everyone should know that, you know, if they're stationed in a foreign land, they don't go out and rape and pillage the village. But I'm saying, are there gray areas where they actually have to be given an instructional book to know not to cross into those gray areas so they don't get involved in really bad behavior which could cause embarrassment to the United States Army?
Unfortunately, there's something called the rules of engagement. I like to call it how not to commit war crimes.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, and my last unit, I was in charge of training. And in my retirement ceremony, I made sure they got this training. For some reason, the military, the Navy at least, was not enthusiastic about sailors learning how not to commit war crimes. I do not know why it is. For example, if I wanted to learn military cooking or accounting or how to plant landmines, I just walked into the library, took out the book, and no one kept any record on it. If I wanted to learn how not to commit war crimes, they made me sign the book out and return the book after I was finished.
Mm-hmm.
That was the difference. Just a week or two ago, some Marines were caught doing dastardly deeds to some dead combatants.
Mm-hmm.
That's blatantly a war crime, and it can't
mm-hmm.
be tolerated now. As I was in the service for 21 years, after 9/11, they were more willing to let us learn how to avoid committing war crimes, and they would let us keep the books after that period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And my last 2 weeks in the service, I made sure my unit was briefed on how not to commit war crimes.
Don?
Yes, Dennis.
The military, and I went to a military college. The military is only interested in you being functional to perform your military actions. So therefore, if you can take orders and follow the orders to a T, they consider you functional. They really don't want you to think about what you're doing, because if they're given orders, they don't want any contradictions. So yes, there's rules of conduct. They have bulletins, rules of behavior in this environment and that environment that most people don't read anyway. But they're interested in, can you be functional? If you can be functional, they're happy.
Uh-huh. Okay. Thank you for sharing that with me. That being said, I'd like to go to The Path of the Righteous Gentile, which is authored by Rabbi Chaim, Yaakov Rogalsky and Rabbi Chaim Klorfin. And we're in the section of Knowing God. And this section that we're going to be reading from, and we'll take it nice and slowly, because it involves people basically reevaluating, you know, what is divine thought as opposed to human thought. So basically these are teachings, I believe, from Rambam as well. Let me just check this footnote here. Let's see. Yeah, no, actually, this is from the Tanya, which is from the first Lubavitcher Rebbe. So this is what's written here as follows. Then anyone want to contribute, Dennis or Kartra, you're welcome. And anyone in the last 25 minutes that want to make the show a little more organic with a surprise phone call, you can call in at 347-838-8669. That's 347-838-8669. So it reads as follows. The error that mundane philosophers, meaning those who extract out any conceptualization of divinity in the process of perceiving what is the totality of the creation, the error that mundane philosophers make, which leads them to believe that God created the world and then abandoned it to its own devices, is that they assume that the creative process of God is the same as that for man. In fact, it is far different. As it is written, quote, "For my thoughts are not like your thoughts," and, quote, "Thus my ways are higher than your ways." And that's from Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah, who we talked about before, chapter 55, verses 8-9. the human condition is only capable of creating something from something. For instance, a human craftsman takes a little piece of silver and fashions a vessel from it. And then when the craftsman removes his hand from his creation, the vessel remains, the silver cup, the silver ring. And this is because the craftsman merely changes the form of the created substance. However, when the Almighty created the heavens and earth, he made them from absolute nothingness. And were he to remove this created force, they would be as they were before he brought them forth to the state of real creation. That is to say, the creation itself would be non-existent. So, Dennis, we've talked about these concepts, ex nihilo. In the Hebrew, it's called yesh ma'ayin, creating something from nothing. Why are people, you think, still battling with these ideas that only God can create something from nothing, and instead associating him with this as the works of man, flesh and blood, that he took something already and made it into something else?
Well, it's a thing called phantoms of your mind. What happens is if you try to do everything in your mind, you develop shadows or phantoms there. And that is when you start to second-guess yourself, you're saying, well, maybe I didn't think about it correctly, or maybe I came to the wrong conclusion. And this is why we're imperfect humans. We cannot figure out everything as if it was a perfect world. But that's where our faith and belief comes in. If you don't have enough faith and belief, well, then you're going to always second, third-guess yourself. So if you don't absorb the concept of creation out of nothing, you're going to supply your own concept. That's okay, but you got to live with it. You got to understand with it, and you're not committing a sin by not believing in that. But that removes the basic foundation for other beliefs. So you must be careful here as to what you reject. When in effect, sometimes if you don't think your brain can handle it, you should accept. Why? It's easier. And if it's all in good faith, all in God's faith, you're not going to go wrong.
Beautiful. I want to comment on that. But first, Cartel, do you have anything to say about that?
Sorry, I don't.
Okay. I just want to go back. When I was almost 24 years old, I had an emergency appendectomy. And I remember as my body was quitting on me because of the sharp pains I was feeling on the side of my stomach, that I literally was losing control of my ability to function as a human being. And, you know, thank God my appendix did not explode. That would have been a very hairy situation. And as I was being taken into the ambulance and driven to the hospital, which was Good Samaritan Hospital out in, I think it's Suffern, New York, very nice hospital. They took very good care of me. I remember at one point when I was being wheeled into the operation room, and I had already been given a muscle relaxing injection, because it was basically, you know, it was either the appendix or me. One of us had to go, and thank God it was the appendix. That as I was before I was being put under, I made like a little prayer to God and said, "Listen, you know, I'm in your hands now. There's nothing else I can do." So, you know, sometimes we run into situations intellectually or even, you know, in our life experiences. Like, for instance, you know, for those of us who travel occasionally on a regular basis on planes, to me, it's a great time to fortify one's faith when one's in the air, because literally we feel how puny we are in relation to the rest of the universe as that which seems so big, our homes, our communities, our cities, our nation. When you're up in the air, it looks like a speck of dust when you're 30,000 feet up in the air. So someone's running the show. It certainly isn't us, although we are welcomed and blessed to participate in it. Dennis, any comments on my feedback?
Yes, what happens is years ago, we used to have people who used to warn about the future and be more God-fearing, etc. And some of that was later turned into a joke because some people say, I'm going to take a plane and fly. And others say, why are you doing that? If God wanted you to fly, he would have given you wings. So that sometimes doesn't make sense, but it is a joke of some type. So therefore, living here on Earth is is an experience, and we must treat it as an experience and go through it. Why? Because the world is not going to disintegrate, or you're not going to step in a crack in the sidewalk and fall all the way down into the center of the earth. A lot of people have a lot of fears about that. If the earth opens up and I step in it, they'll never know what happened to me. When don't worry about the future if your faith and belief is strong enough, because what's going to happen will happen, and we're all in God's hands. One last thing that you mentioned a couple of minutes ago when you were quoting some of that stuff from the rabbi's book is that my belief is that God does not abandon anything. If you think God is going to abandon you, you are thinking the absolute wrong way. No matter what happens to you, no matter how bad you are, God does not abandon you. He made you. He made you in the recreation of the original creation, and time goes on. You have God on your side.
That's right. And on the flip side, Dennis, and no matter how good you are, and a person's going through tremendous tests, that sometimes good people are given, overwhelming tests to see how good can they really be. Well, the same God who empowered you to be good will certainly stand right by your side, you know, figuratively speaking, because he's not standing anywhere. He's all around us and all over the creation. He's there to empower you as well. So whether a person is evil or good or somewhere in between and not knowing which direction to turn in, you know, as Yogi Berra once said, when you get to the fork in the road, remember to take it. But let's just remember, the Most High made the fork in the road for us to make those choices. Do we go to the right side of the fork of the road or the left side, meaning the right choice or the left choice? But the Most High placed before us that fork. Okay, well, one more teaching from this book, Path of Rise Gentile, and we'll move on to Compassion for Humanity in the Jewish Tradition, then wind up the show with Meditations of Gratitude, based on the verse in chapter 2, verse 7 in Genesis. So the Rogalski and Chlorfin state the following. So if we go back to the words of truth that we just mentioned before, that only the Most High in his realm to create something from nothingness, it should be apparent that since the original creation started as nothing and now is something, still in truth, the creation itself is considered null and non-existent with respect to the activating divine force of the Most High and the breath of his mouth, which is allegorically speaking. But that does not mean that creation is an illusion. It does mean that the godliness, the Most High's divine force, is the true existence of all of creation. And this creation, which is blessed, has no independent existence of its own. For it should be remembered that the example of God removing his original 10 utterances was hypothetical. God has no such intention. The universe is real. It is, however, nullified to its creator, meaning the intent of the creation is according to the intent of the creator. So how can we possibly assert that this, in fact, this universe is real? Because there have been philosophers who questioned the tangibility of this universe as to whether or not it is real or is merely an illusion of our limited human sensory perceptions. Insomuch as the rabbis continued to say, our limited senses and intellect are part of the created universe. The proof that they offer is inconclusive. We are part of the very thing that may not exist, but yet there is one proof that the earth really exists. It says so in the Torah, as it's written in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and earth. And I feel sorry for the person, Dennis, that would think that the heavens and earth that God created is merely an illusion. Any comments or concerns about that statement or what I just read?
Yeah, what happens is God made the earth from nothing. We understand what the concept of God is, and we have a pretty good handle on what creation is. The word that gives us humans a hard time is the word nothing. We use it, but if we think about it, we can't visualize nothing. We can't even see nothing. But
right.
We know it's a strange place that doesn't register on the human scale. Because what is it? Is it big, large? How tall is it? How wide is it?
Right.
Don't know what it is. Is it just an atom, a molecule? We can't see an atom or a molecule, but if it was an atom or a molecule, then it wouldn't be nothing. That means it's something. So we have a hard time using human reasoning to understand the metaphysical concepts that are put in God made the world out of nothing. It starts with God, and God is associated with faith and belief. To understand the whole statement, you must have some faith and belief, because if God did it, it must be good.
True. Dennis, I like what you just said, and I just to further elaborate on what you just said, that let's say a person says, I will think of nothing right now. I'll empty myself of all thoughts. But in that process, you're concentrating on emptying via the soul garment of thought that there should be no thought. So there is a thought that we are engaging in to remove all thoughts. So that in itself is a thought. But again, the Most High's thoughts, as we learned just now from the prophet Isaiah, his thoughts are not our thoughts. And his the realm of what we consider to be a thought, which from the Hebrew teachings, the Torah teachings, is a combination of letters in the mind. Well, when we use letters in our mind, and we've talked about this lots of times, Dennis, that human language is extremely limiting. It can be for our advantage, and it also can be for our disadvantage. But the Most High, when he engages in whatever is considered to be on the divine level of thought, his thoughts do not limit him from being who he is, and he's not caught up in his thoughts. It just happens to be that he is the source of all thought, and therefore he is the source of all possibility, and his divine thought is a catalyst for what is according to his divine will, wisdom, and of course expressed mercies towards the creation for the fact that he gave us life without any pretext or condition that we should be whatever we should be, but rather he gave us the free choice to choose what we are going to be or what we want to be. And of course that's also, I would call, Rambamian thinking, you know, the power of human free choice to engage in what is proper. But even before we make that decision, we've already been brought into being, you know, prior to us having any conscious of a responsibility to do what's right or to take the wrong path and do what's wrong. Any comments on that, Dennis?
Yes, you have the free right. You have the right to be stupid. But not everybody wants to be stupid. Why be stupid? That's not a right. So you got to be careful how you use the term, because you may get what you wish for. And if you say, I'm using my free will and I want to be stupid, fine. Well, you don't have to work at that, folks. You can just go ahead and be stupid anytime. But it can also be the opposite if you so choose. And the opposite is not being stupid. Well, maybe you can pick up some common sense, a little belief, some faith, and live a happy life.
Dennis, you're dealing with the good stuff. You always can share that good stuff on this show. So I want to go now to Compassion for Humanity in the Jewish Tradition. This is from Rabbi Chaim Ibn Attar, who is known as the Or HaChaim, the Light of Life. That was one of the books he wrote. And usually in Jewish tradition, when a rabbi wrote a seminal work, he became associated with the name of one of the books he wrote. So he wrote the following, which to me is based on a teaching in Genesis chapter 2, verse 1. It says, God transcends and encompasses the universe. At the same time, God imbues the universe with life. In truth, everything that exists possesses the ability to recognize the Creator according to its nature and spiritual level. Living beings, whether or not they possess the faculty of speech, vegetation, even inanimate objects, every creature longs for God, and God cares for every creature. Therefore, God made the earth a sphere, around the orb as we know it, to teach us that all the earth's inhabitants should feel equally close to Him. So, Dennis, my question to you is, how come people don't feel equally close to God, or how come people are not encouraging other people to feel equally close to God?
The word here is close. That is a relative word. It's the difference of what an engineer would call close or a physicist would call close. If you had to go point to A to B, and it was only 5 feet, but the only you could move along that line any time as long as you half the distance every time you advanced.
Mm-hmm.
How close can you get to the end point if you're always halving the distance of your target? The physicist said, well, you can never get close because you're always going to be halving something. The engineer would say, I can get very, very, very close. So here we have a world of what is close. If you can think about God, you have a relationship. Whether you are close or not is really immaterial. The idea is opening up a line of communications that you can use because God is there to help you. If you don't need help, you don't need God. That means you're totally self-sufficient. You have everything you could possibly want. If that's so, then what the hell are you doing on the planet? You're a human. We don't have that luxury. We are not perfectionists. We try to be, but open up that line of communication with God called thinking, and it will come to you. We all do it in different ways, and we all register it differently, but we recognize the Almighty Being.
Beautiful, Dennis. Now we're coming to the dessert of the show, I'd like to call it, where we're going to engage in a couple of meditations of gratitude, maybe three meditations, we'll see, depending on the interaction between Dennis and I. We're based on a verse in Genesis chapter 2, verse 7. We've been doing this for several weeks now, which I don't have a problem with, blessed souls, because I think it's very important for us to realize that when we read this verse, quote, then the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul, unquote. That, again, we started from dust. We didn't start from gold. We didn't start from silver. We didn't start from a precious jewel. We started from that which we trample upon each day of our living lives, whether we're walking on the sidewalk or out in the countryside. But yet from that which we trample upon, we were formed from the dust. So one of the meditations of gratitude that is brought down in Torah anthology is that it's taught the following. If you have the blessings to have money, think about what good deeds you can do or to give to charity. And you should do it as soon as the opportunity presents itself. Do not say, quote, when I save a certain amount, I will put aside some for charity. This is the advice of the tempter, which is the advice of the Satan. No man knows how long he will live or when his time will come. Therefore, one has an obligation to charity as soon as possible. You must realize that the Almighty has done you a great favor in granting you money, and then you must in turn do his will and have mercy on the poor. When you have the ability to give charity, it is as if you owe a debt to the Most High. You must realize that certainly God does not give you property merely so you and your family are able to eat. The Most High himself designates your money for charity. Besides this, there is also divine promise, which is brought down in the Torah law, that God will repay any money that you put out for charity. You therefore have an opportunity to do two things at once. First, you can give charity and do other good deeds and thus be worthy of the world to come. Besides this, you will also be able to eat and drink in pleasant fashion without having to rely on others. And this is a very, very big test again in these days. But then, it's, you know, we're not asking anyone to empty up their bank accounts and become beggars themselves, but to learn how to estimate what they can give, and hopefully they can give with a cheery countenance. Any comments or concerns about this?
Yes, humans weren't meant to live in isolation. The last two words of that verse 7 is living soul. We all are part with the living soul. Not a dead soul, the words are living. They could have left out the word living and just said soul. Wouldn't it have been the same meaning? I don't think so. They're reminding people, you are living. You are participating in life. You are breathing the air. You are engaging in the atmosphere, the earth. And it's not by choice. When you are born, you automatically become a participant in life. That life was created by the Almighty. And you have a living soul. Therefore, you should honor other living souls. And since we weren't designed to be all by ourselves, we were meant to communicate to live with. You must help those people who need the help. Not everybody needs the help. Some people are very self-sufficient. Others aren't. So therefore, we must give some help. It occurs in many different forms.
True.
People recognize it when you give it.
True. One last meditation. Yeah, I'm sorry, yes, Dennis, you want to add something?
No, go ahead, Don.
Okay. So the last meditation we'll share tonight, and then we're going to go to a song by our good friend David Dome from England. And the song is called Truly God Knows, and we all know that. So let's say you go on a trip and you carefully pack your luggage, taking along everything that you need. And even if you're not going very far, there's always a concern that you may be delayed and need something. Similarly, when there are rumors of impending food shortages, people hoard whatever food they can find. So, too, you must also make provision for your soul. It is not enough that a person should refrain from doing which is wrong, which the world calls sinning, or avoiding malicious gossip and vain oaths, since this does not nourish the soul in the world to come, olam haba. You therefore must strive to do good deeds and, as we learn more about them, to try to keep the commandments of the Most High. If you prepare to go for a short trip, you must do even more carefully than for a lengthy journey. The longest journey that you will ever take is from this world to the next, and you must be especially careful to prepare the necessary provisions. As John Lennon said, you don't take nothing but your soul, think, but you can take with you, which are not physical matters, the merits that you have accumulated by being engaged in acts of kindness towards the other members of the human family, and as you learn more about deciding which commandments hopefully you'll want to keep as much as you can to try to strengthen your connection between you and God. So, Dennis, any concluding statements on your part before we sign off?
Yes, we have a human expression for that, and that's called keep a little bit in your back pocket. That concept means whatever you do, be prepared for good times and bad times. You do that by keeping a little bit of something, some resources, in your back pocket. It doesn't have to be physically your back pocket, but you keep it as your own resource that you're going to need in case of bad times.
Beautiful. Dennis, I'd like to thank you for coming on the program today. Again, I think we had a rich, very engaging conversation with yourself and also George Washington Carver, Business League President, Karchal Gore. You know, Bessels, I like to usually sign off with some sort of witty statement, but I think I've humbled myself a little bit to realize I think the best way to end off, aside from introducing a song from good friend David Dome, who helps us get home to the positioning of our reconfiguring our human intelligence to our divine image, to end off with a little scripture prophecy, and I'll try to pick up something from scripture every week. This is coming from Isaiah 25:1, which says the following. God, master of legions, will make for all the nations on this mountain, the mountain of Jerusalem, a feast of fats, a feast of lees, rich fats, and concentrated lees. On this mountain he will eliminate the faces wearing veils that are veiled, and of all nations and all masks that mask all the nations. He will eliminate death forever, and my Lord God Elohim will erase tears from all faces. And that's what we hope to see in our generation, but so the eradication of tears from all faces. So we're going to end the show now, wishing everyone a beautiful week. This has been Soul Class number 130, In Search of Ancient Authentic Torah, class number 30 in this series. Here is now, Truly God Knows, because who knows better than God, for truly God knows. Our good friend David Dome. Take care, everyone.
What do you say? Tell me what it's all about, yeah. take what he knows.